believe most of you know me by now, but I am Jennifer Piscopo. I was a Gates Cambridge Scholar in 2002, and I am now the new co-chair of the Gates Scholars Alumni Association. So any complaints, but preferably enthusiastic congratulations and offers to get involved, you may eject direct to me after. So before we begin, clearly I have a lot of thank yous. The first thank you is to our three guest speakers, whom I'll introduce to you in a moment, having traveled here often under tight schedules and juggling other commitments. So I'm just so pleased to have them with us today. I also want to thank Jennifer Gibson. None of us would be here this weekend were it not for the efforts of Jennifer Gibson and the other now outgoing co-chairs of the GSAA, Andrew Robinson and Hillary Levy, who have put this all together, and the trust for enabling us financially and materially to be here, and Jim Smith as well. Let me make a brief introduction to my ideas in conceiving this panel, and then I will introduce our speakers. And I always find that if somebody reads to me three speaker biographies at once, I get confused, so I'll introduce the speakers and their biographies one by one as they speak. So I thought of this panel when I was considering that global, national, and local communities confront dilemmas, both political and moral, relating to the protection of minorities and human rights. And so we need not look any further than current debates in Europe on whether or not Muslim women should wear the headscarf and the burqa in public spaces to see that there are very urgent questions about who belongs to our communities, what types of diverse groups belong to our communities, what national identities are part of our communities, and how should they be expressed. So it seemed to me, given this and other debates happening in Europe, that a panel on multiculturalism, minorities, and human rights should be of interest to those of us gathered today. So the purpose of the panel is to explore some of these questions relating to rights and freedoms of minority groups, and we're going to think about what are the rights and the freedoms enjoyed by individuals and groups, and what makes a group a minority, what are their boundaries of belonging to their minority community or to their host community if they're immigrants, and if they are immigrants or minorities or newly arrived groups, what accommodations does the host society or the majority polity owe to the minorities, particularly if they have practices that may be different, and particularly if there are historical circumstances of unfair treatment to those who are different. So our panelists are going to address these questions through their various lenses of expertises, hopefully raise more questions, and I have the unfortunate job of keeping our panelists to a fairly strict 15 minutes, and the purpose of that is then to have a lively discussion. So, and enable you to ask questions. So our first panelist will be Dr. Andrea Baumeister. She is a senior lecturer in politics at the University of Stirling. Her research focuses on the challenges that a politics of difference and cultural diversity pose for liberal democracies in general and liberal conceptions of citizenship in particular. Her current research projects explore the relationship between gender equality and cultural justice and the role of religion in the liberal public realm. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for inviting me. Within 15 minutes, the comments will have to be fairly general. But to start off with, feminism and multiculturalism, at first glance, appear to have much in common. Both are often described as part of an identity politics or a politics of difference. And indeed, in their search for more inclusive conceptions of justice, both highlight the importance of difference and diversity. Both reject abstract, unitary conceptions of citizenship in favor of a contextual identity that recognizes our particular attachments, concerns, and perspectives. Furthermore, both are critical of notions of formal equality that define equality in terms of identical individual rights. Therefore, for many feminists and multiculturalists, true equality requires group-specific rights which recognize the particular needs and vulnerabilities of particular groups. But despite these shared concerns and goals, significant tensions remain between key feminist concerns and strands of multiculturalism. Many established cultural and religious customs discriminate against women and cannot be easily reconciled with the norm of gender equality. Here, feminists frequently express concerns about the impact upon women of practices such as female circumcision, polygamy, child marriages or forced marriages, and gender-differentiated rules regarding divorce. In addition, there are worries relating to gender equality in relation to access to education, employment, and vulnerability to violence. Yet, while from a feminist perspective, many cultural and religious customs that relate to women are profoundly problematic, cultures typically attach great significance to the cultural expectations and rules that shape gender roles. In this context, women and their bodies often assume a particular symbolic cultural significance. Not only do women reproduce future members of the group, they usually also play a vital role in the transmission of the collective identity from one generation to the next, as well as the public demarcation of group membership through symbols such as dress. Think of, for example, the burqa. The subsequent desire to uphold traditional gender roles can be particularly acute in the case of cultures that seek to preserve their identity and way of life in the face of what are perceived as unwelcome forms of assimilation. Indeed, disputes regarding the role of women and the regulation of sex, birth, and marriage have been amongst the most bitter and divisive cultural struggles. Nonetheless, while questions of cultural justice have played a prominent role in liberal political theory for some considerable time, theorists have been slow to consider the impact of group rights upon gender equality. Indeed, some have explicitly invoked the notion of individual and group autonomy to argue that out of respect for cultural diversity, the state should not intervene in the private sphere of family, religious, and personal life. But from a feminist perspective, this is deeply troubling. As feminist scholars have long argued, if women are to achieve equal citizenship, power relations in the private sphere must be subject to critical analysis and political intervention, and gender bias in the public sphere must be challenged. So while a commitment to pluralism and diversity may be taken to imply that liberal societies should seek to accommodate concerns and practices that are of particular importance to minorities, the accommodation of traditional rules and expectations surrounding gender roles is liable to leave women members of minority groups vulnerable to grave injustice and may buttress some of the most inegalitarian aspects of a culture. Now, in recent debates, this paradox has been particularly apparent in three related areas: the use of cultural defense in criminal trials, demands by non-liberal minorities for self-government, and campaigns by religious and cultural minorities for the recognition of traditional personal and family law. Now, although no legal jurisdiction formally recognizes a cultural defense, in a number of well-publicized cases, defense lawyers and judges in the US and Australia have argued that a more inclusive conception of justice, which recognizes the claims of diversity, implies that immigrant defendants or defendants from cultural minorities should be judged according to their own cultural standards rather than those of the relevant jurisdiction. But in many cases, these cultural standards, such as the alleged acceptability of male violence, rape, and honor killings, are at odds with the commitment to gender equality. Another set of issues has been highlighted by the demands of indigenous peoples for self-government. In Canada, for instance, Aboriginal leaders have argued that self-governing Aboriginal communities should not be subject to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, since the Charter's typically liberal language of individual rights and freedoms is alien to traditional Aboriginal norms and values, and therefore not compatible with the respect for genuine cultural diversity. But at least some Native women in Canada feared that in the absence of the individual rights enshrined in the Charter, their sex equality rights might not be protected. A third set of concerns stems from campaigns by religious and cultural minorities for the recognition of personal and family law. Personal and family law is clearly of great significance to many religious and cultural groups. Rules pertaining to marriage and divorce, for example, often play an important role in enshrining group membership and defining the boundaries between the group and outsiders. Indeed, as far as membership and group boundaries are concerned, family law for religious and cultural groups fulfills a role akin to that of citizenship law for the state. But far from being gender neutral, such practices and traditions often impose a significantly greater burden upon women. Now, given that many, although by no means all, cultural and religious communities that seek recognition are more patriarchal than the dominant culture in contemporary liberal democracies, there's a prima facie tension between demands for the recognition of communities' traditional personal and family law and a commitment to promote gender equality. Now, in the face of the tensions that I've tried to map in these three areas, between gender equality on the one hand and cultural justice on the other, feminists may, of course, well be tempted to argue that given the fundamental commitment to equality and individual liberty, a liberal state must assert the priority of women's rights to equal treatment. And it is this thought which, for instance, led Susan Okin to suggest that multiculturalism may well be bad for women. This, however, strikes me as underestimating the complex challenges that these dilemmas pose. To simply portray these tensions as struggles of gender equality versus cultural justice obscures the multifaceted interests and complex loyalties of women who are members of cultural groups seeking recognition. For many minority women, their cultural heritage is not just a symbol of oppression, but also a source of value and meaning, of empowerment and resistance. Even where women are critical of established cultural practices, they often have simultaneously a wide variety of reasons for continuing with these practices, ranging from the protection of their social identity and sense of self to practical and strategic advantages, such as protecting the standing of their community and the privileges this entails. In fact, many indigenous feminist movements reside within their cultural traditions. The aim of such movements is not to liberate women from their cultural heritage, but to promote greater gender equality through the reform and reinterpretation of group norms and practices. Such women's movements often challenge the secular liberalizing assumptions that underpin dominant conceptions of gender equality. For example, Muslim women rights activists, such as the transnational network Women Living Under Muslim Law, seek to promote gender equality and freedom within a distinctly Islamic framework. Not only do such indigenous feminist movements highlight differences in the ways in which women experience and respond to patriarchy and the degree to which notions of what constitutes equality, including gender equality, are historically contingent and contextual, they also illustrate the extent to which cultures are internally contested, heterogeneous, and fluid. Indeed, the perception of an irreconcilable conflict between gender equality and cultural rights arguably springs in part from a misleading cultural essentialism that exaggerates the solidity of and differences between cultures and that overstates the extent culture determines individual conduct, giving rise to a picture of women and girls from minority groups as helpless victims of patriarchal values who lack autonomy. A cultural essentialism that reduces disputed practices to simple conflicts of culture not only obscures the strategic and political struggles for power and access to resources that underpin many of the issues that have given rise for concern among feminists, but also runs the risk of effectively silencing minority and third world women by reducing them to stereotypical exemplars. These concerns point to the need for a much more nuanced conception of culture. While culture, just like race, class, and gender, influences and constrains individuals, it is not a blueprint for action, but shifting, historically contingent, open to interpretation, and frequently contested. Given such a more nuanced understanding of both gender equality and culture, there may not necessarily be a stark conflict between a commitment to women's rights and the respectful recognition of cultural norms. On the contrary, not only may the way in which we understand rights be in need of cultural interpretation, to refuse to take seriously demands by minority women for the accommodation of practices and norms that do not sit well with mainstream conceptions of equality may itself undermine women's rights, most notably the key feminist goal of a right to self-determination. Now, this complex interaction between gender equality and culture points to the need to empower women within their own cultural traditions. But that goal itself raises complex challenges. And here I think it is useful to distinguish between two potential strategies which have shaped recent academic debates: authentic choice on the one hand and participation on the other. While the authentic choice strategy conceives of empowering women in terms of their capacity to control their lives and to exercise effective choices, the participation strategy focuses on the need to ensure that women are properly represented in decision and policy-making procedures. Now, both strategies undoubtedly identify potentially important aspects of empowerment, but both also encounter recurrent problems, which raise doubts about their viability. While advocates of an authentic choice approach have attempted to develop different sensitive accounts of conditions for authentic choice, even sophisticated accounts arguably continue to privilege typically liberal feminist concerns. In essence, critics of authentic choice models persistently express a worry that such models will ultimately only be able to recognize those choices which meet liberal standards as authentic. Now, part of the problem here is a methodological one. Because it's often difficult to establish whether women who continue to endorse traditional practices and lifestyles genuinely had the opportunity to develop a more autonomous life, there is a danger that only the rejection of such lifestyles will be taken as conclusive proof that women indeed had the opportunity to develop the relevant capabilities or enjoy the conditions for procedural autonomy. So in practice, advocates of an authentic choice strategy may find it difficult to respect women's freedom to continue to endorse their traditional way of life and not to avail themselves of certain opportunities. Now, these problems may make feminists more interested in the participation strategy, which seeks to empower women by creating new institutional mechanisms that facilitate critical debate about established cultural norms and practices. Now, from this perspective, disputes regarding gender and culture are not primarily normative disputes, but are political disputes, and are best analyzed in terms of power. Advocates of this strategy, therefore, focus on developing innovative institutional mechanisms that enable women from minority communities to play a greater role in decision-making and to challenge existing norms and power relations. But proponents of the participation approach persistently struggle to adequately define the background conditions that need to be met for women to make effective use of the opportunities for participation and voice that their models aim to facilitate. Potentially marginalized and vulnerable group members such as women will only be able to make effective use of opportunities to participate in decision-making forums and to reshape norms and regulations to their own advantage if they enjoy a substantive degree of independence. At a minimum, this requires that some of the most serious structural difficulties such as economic deprivation and lack of education are addressed. Now, an emphasis on material conditions and trying to cash out agency in these terms, of course, falls well short of the kind of demands that an authentic choice model that focuses on autonomy may make. And in that sense, it may avoid some of the difficulties that have beset authentic choice approaches to the question of culture and justice, gender and cultural justice. But even if we cash out agency in terms of material, an emphasis on material resources, education that ensures not autonomy but the skills for gainful employment, and essentially focus on traditional feminist concerns to do with the material well-being for women, even if we cash out agency in these terms, this will still set very significant limits to a participation strategy for dealing with the question of gender and culture. So ultimately, we can agree on empowering women in minority cultures as the answer towards the potential tensions between gender equality and cultural justice. But cashing this idea out, working out how this is to be done, continues to be a difficult question. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Joshua Castellino. Joshua Castellino was appointed professor of law and head of law and head of the law department at Middlesex University in London. He is also an adjunct professor of law at the Irish Center for Human Rights at Galway in Ireland. He trained and worked as a journalist in India before winning a Shivning scholarship to pursue a master's in international law and politics at the University of Hull. It's a very international profile. He completed his PhD in international law in 1998. He is the author of 5 books and multiple articles, which variously address international law and comparative constitutional law, self-determination, territorial land rights, and minority rights in Asia and the Pacific. He has extensive experience engaging in human rights discussions at intergovernmental, governmental, and non-governmental levels, and has been involved in discussions with law societies and NGOs around the world on issues of human rights. And he has a handout for you, which we're going to principally project here. Yeah. And if you just want to let me know when to scroll down.
Will do. Yeah.
Or if you want to sit. Yeah.
This comes with a bit of a health warning, which is what I have to say may have little or no bearing to what's up there. mainly that's because I have 15 minutes to give you some sense, I think, of the battle that we're up against. And what you have there really hopefully are starting points, that if you want to go back and look at some of these issues or look up some of these issues, some of that might give you an indicator, and there's a select bibliography at the end of it. I want to just start by drawing your attention to something that Paul Collier has recently been talking about, the bottom billion. Essentially, his argument is simplified, of course, because he's an economist, I'm a lawyer, we can't really always agree on terms, but essentially his argument is that there are 5 of the world's 6 billion people who either live in or aspire to 21st century conditions, and there's a bottom billion that live in 14th century feudalistic conditions. And his argument basically is that unless we tackle this particular divide, we're not likely to see a world where human rights are respected, and it might have grave consequences for security. And as we know, we all seem to be living in a culture of security at the moment. So I think I want to start with that and suggest to you really that Paul Collier's analysis is based on the assumption that India and China, being 2 large countries accounting for nearly 2.5 billion people, are already in the 5 of the 6 billion population. That's what makes the big difference. And Collier basically suggests that this bottom billion, as he puts it, live in sub-Saharan Africa and various other states, LDCs as we call them in development economic terms. Now, I'm suggesting to you that that analysis is flawed, and I'm suggesting to you it's flawed because actually the bottom billion live within states. I don't think it's quite as simple as the bottom billion being in sub-Saharan Africa and the wealthy being somewhere else. The Indian context is a case in point, and I've done quite a lot of work in India and in China as well. India at the moment is shining, so the government tells us. 8% growth rates, remarkable in a financial crisis. But essentially, that 8% growth rate pertains to 250 million people. That's a lot, isn't it? That's nearly two-thirds the EU. But there are 750 million people in India who are seeing increased poverty and who are increasingly been seen as a hindrance to the growth rate. So multinational corporations are quite happy to go into places like India because, you know, if you sell 250 million cans of Coke, you're doing pretty well. So we're quite happy to go into places like India and work with the 250 million because it's worth it. The 750 million, on the other hand, get in the way. And this really was, in a sense, the start of my inquiry. When I was working as a journalist, what I often found, especially among slum dwellers in places like Bombay, was that there was this drive towards development, but that the development didn't mean anything. And instead of human rights being an empowering tool, human rights and the law in general were seen as tools that ultimately were written by the rich for the rich. And my quest really began in that particular context, to understand the extent to which human rights law could address these problems. Now, the health warning on human rights, I mean, the big headlines on it, it tells you that human rights is a system of laws ultimately designed to protect the inherent dignity and worth of every individual. Every individual, not just the wealthy, not just those who contribute to society, but every individual. Well, how is it then that we live in a world of increasing poverty? And how is it then that our human rights mechanisms, increasingly sophisticated though they are, have less and less impact among the poor and among minorities and vulnerable groups? And that's a fundamental challenge. You already know as a human rights lawyer that your discourse is in trouble when the likes of Bush and Blair can stand up and say, we are going to Iraq to protect the human rights of the Iraqis. You know then you're in trouble because human rights has become such a malleable tool and such a cause of rhetoric that everybody can claim a piece of the action. Now, one of my takes on this subject, in a sense, and of course human rights academia is rife with this, and I'm a human rights academic too. We do a lot of writing about what kind of rights exist, how these rights intersect, what are the conflicts between rights. But actually, I've come to the conclusion that the human rights debate is not about the what, it's about the who. It's not about what rights do we have. We more or less know that now. We've codified 9 international conventions on a range of issues, women's rights, children's rights, rights of the disabled, racial discrimination, civil and political rights, economic and social rights. We've codified all of these things. We more or less have an idea and can agree on what the fundamental rights are. Yet we continue having a discussion about what the rights are, when actually the fundamental question is who? Who are the victims of these rights? And the victims of the rights, if you did a survey of Collier's Bottom Billion and minorities and indigenous peoples globally, they intersect. Because you often find minorities and indigenous peoples at the bottom of every single society. Now, that's, don't take my word for it. Go and look up GDP per head. Go and look up educational attainments. Go and look at parliaments and look at the extent to which there are minorities and represented in parliament. It's a fundamental fact, probably, uncontestable, probably, that minorities and indigenous peoples are at the bottom of this hierarchy. If you think about the whole law project and the whole human rights project locating itself in law, it was radical at the time. 1948, we passed this Universal Declaration for Human Rights, coming up with this idea that actually law was there to protect the rights and dignity of all. Law had always had that rhetoric about it, but law has always had this tension as well. On the one hand, the laws were written and framed by landowners, even in ancient Greece, not women, not slaves, but landowners, and law was written to protect property. So ultimately, law was a weapon that you used against the poor and against those who didn't have to protect what you had from being seized by them. So the idea of locating human rights in the context of law was quite remarkable because it basically said, listen, law isn't just about maintaining order, it's about maintaining justice and order. Or just order. And I don't mean just order in the diminutive sense, but just order in the sense that the order must have a degree of justice to it. So the human rights movement has kicked off from that in 1948, and we've come a long way. But actually, my title, and that there's some relevance of the sheet, that title still makes sense. No Room at the Inn. Why International Law is Failing Minorities. Even though we've come to this sophisticated international human rights legal regime today, there actually is no room at the inn for minorities. It is still difficult to find a way in which minorities can access this law. The question is why? Well, I mean, I can go into these in questions if you want to, because my research project at the moment involves a series of 5 books, essentially looking at the extent to which domestic legal systems provide access to minorities and indigenous peoples. Saying, listen, don't buy into the fact that states tell you they have human rights. Instead, do some kind of analysis through which you can understand how it is that minorities, indigenous peoples, and vulnerable groups can actually access that law. Because by and large, most laws are framed in a capital city, collecting dust in the national archives in the capital city. And they have little or no relevance outside that context. Sure, you have some entrepreneurial lawyers who can go out there and take class actions. You have them, and we thank God for them, because they are the ones who actually make a change. But they are few and far between. So we haven't systemized this yet. We instead have created a highlight, and we hope that that highlight will serve as a beacon to attract minorities and indigenous peoples to use the law. But very often, minorities, for practical reasons, can't access the law. It's not written in their language, for a start. And I mean that both in the sense of language, the language they speak, but also language, the context in which the rights are written. Very often, there are practical difficulties. How many minorities do law, for a start? How many minorities globally actually end up in law school? Again, if they're not going to do law, how are they going to make a legal case? So there are all of these aspects, practical and conceptual difficulties with it. There is the debate that Andrea referred to in terms of collective and the individual, and how do these intersect? So there are some real difficulties with it. I think essentially what you do find is that states are struggling with this particular question. And what I've tried to do is to look at various different domestic regimes and try and understand what it is that makes states try to resolve some of these issues. Now, for a long time, minority rights discourse, in a sense, was dominated by the Western paradigm, if you like. So you look at Ghana and you say, oh, Ghana, wow, it's a really mixed country. It's got such a lot of ethnic mixture. And some of the Akan are fighting against the other groups. What are we going to do? Well, let's look at what Canada does. Well, let's not look at what Canada does, because what Canada does is pretty much irrelevant in downtown Accra. Let's look at, instead, what's happening in Lagos. So there hasn't been any kind of South-South discussion about these issues. And instead, we constantly look for the silver bullet that we can ultimately say, well, here we are. It's funny, we were in China talking about working with the Chinese government on designing what's called a legal aid bill for essentially indigent who can't access the legal system. And the discussion was going on for a while. And then one of our speakers from our delegation, because there was a European delegate, European in inverted commas because I'm Indian, but there was a European delegation and there was a Chinese delegation. And we were talking about these kinds of issues, and our Austrian colleague stood up and said, you know, gave his piece. But the tone in which he delivered it was, listen, guys, I know you have a problem in China, but wait till you hear what we do in Austria. And the Chinese guys were looking at them and saying, but that's like a suburb of Beijing, isn't it? I mean, why is this relevant? Can it be scaled up? So you're telling us that your model, essentially designed for a suburb in Beijing, but not just a suburb in Beijing, a suburb of rich people in Beijing, can be applied to China. Why do you think that's relevant to us? So, and the quest really is, and certainly my quest in my research work, is to find the extent to which you can find appropriate models to compare. Not necessarily to adopt those models wholesale and design laws wholesale, but to get the discussion going. Just one of the questions I noticed that Jen had on the briefing sheet I got was this difficulty of who a minority is. And again, there's a wide range of literature on the subject. We have a definition. It's not a great one, but I'll share it with you nonetheless, problematic as it might be. It's a Capatorti's definition from 1977, where he basically says a minority is a group inferior, obviously it's numerically inferior to the rest of the population of a state, whose members, being nationals of a state, and that's crucial, it means you've already eliminated asylum seekers, refugees, immigrants, whose members, being nationals of a state, possess ethnic, religious, or linguistic characteristics differing from the rest of the population, and who maintain, if only implicitly, a sense of solidarity. Now, that's the definition we have. There are several problematic aspects about this, and believe me, I can do a whole day on them, so I'm not going to bore you with that. But there are these distinctions that exist between a minority, an indigenous people, and a people. And there's a great deal of difference in how they are classed. Indigenous peoples, in a sense, have all the rights that minorities have, but in addition, they might also have a right to the land. Minorities usually don't have a right to the land. And peoples, on the other hand, in terms of international law, are those who have the right to self-determination, i.e. the right to form their own state. The difficulty that indigenous peoples face at the moment is to understand why it is that they are not peoples. So they say, so you accept that Indians are a people, or Nigerians are a people, or Indonesians are a people. Well, why can't you accept the different indigenous nations as a people? And you say, well, because these people were colonized. And they say, yeah, and we were too. And you say, well, because these people had their lands taken away. Well, we were too. Well, but you know, then we had a transition process and we handed power back. And it's like, yeah, that's right, you haven't had a transition process with us. So we're actually worse. So why don't you consider us peoples? Now, the UN has weighed on in this discussion in 1960, essentially telling us what self-determination was. And there was this whole debate in the General Assembly about what self-determination ought to mean. And the UN told us self-determination essentially entails one of three options. Option A, integration with an existing state. If you're a minority, if you're a nation, are you coming to independence? You can say, I would like to integrate with this state. Fine, you can do that. That's option A. Option B, free association with an existing state. And here we have examples. In the US, you're quite familiar with this. You have associate states. But also in New Zealand, where you have many of the Pacific states that are smaller, Bhutan with India, smaller states that associate with a larger state. Option C is secession, the process through which you break away from an existing state to form yourself into a new, emerging, independent nation. Now, the problem is simple. The international community says, if you are a people, you have a right to self-determination, i.e. you have option A, B, and C. Indigenous peoples and minorities look at that and say, yeah, A and B, forget about it. Actually, we want C. We want to form our new independent state. So you have this clash. And states basically say, well, we can't really have secession because you'll get into what political scientists call the 5,200 argument. There are 5,000 communities and there's 200 states. Are we going to break all down the 200 states till we get 5,000 states? How much will that cost in bloodshed terms? So essentially, international law has got to a stage where it says, well, forget about the self-determination issue. It's closed. Okay. So now it says, self-determination involves rights A, B, or C, except you can't choose A and B. I always think of it as the option of, you know, you're sitting in an airplane, and the host or hostess is coming down, and they say, well, you have chicken or pasta, chicken or pasta. And they come to you and say, well, you have chicken or pasta, except the chicken's finished. You say, well, I think I'll have the pasta then, won't I? Or you have the option, you're working on your computer, and it goes to hell, and things start falling off, and it says, your computer is attacked by a virus, all your files are going to be deleted and the thing is going to explode in 3 seconds, and you have the option of saying, okay. That's a bit like how it is, I think, in terms of international law and indigenous peoples. They say, well, it's not okay actually, but we don't really have a choice. And so this discussion has really hurt quite a lot of the discussion with regards to human rights and the extent to which human rights can actually be in any way feasible. The other aspect is that for a long time, the human rights movement has seen itself as essentially the lone, you know, passionate advocate fighting against impossible odds, engaging in a battle of attrition through which they'll beat the government and get some crumbs from the government for their client. That model doesn't quite work anymore because it's no longer a binary relationship. Multinational corporations are playing a fundamental role. The Indian context I started off with. If you have a multinational corporation that's thinking, God, I want to send 250 million cans of Coke in India, you want to go there. And essentially, you will make the deal you need to make to get there. And you won't necessarily worry about the 750 million. Why? Because they can't afford the can of Coke anyway. So this becomes a big issue. And I think we in the human rights world have missed a trick by not engaging. And not saying all business is bad. I don't at all want to give that impression. But engaging with business. And engaging with business much more. And I think that's the challenge that we face. Just some various tools that have been tried. And again, I can go into more detail on all of these or any of these or none of these or others. Some imperfect models, I think, just to tie in. Very many societies are trying to renegotiate the historical record. Because ultimately, even when you study the history of different places, the history is told from majority perspective. So if the history is told from majority perspective, labeling a bunch of nondescript renegades as being essentially driven by the need to hurt the state, then of course the way people perceive them changes. Places like New Zealand, Guatemala have tried to engage this question. The Waitangi Tribunal in New Zealand is looking at the history of land rights from the Maori perspective. In Guatemala, you have severe massacres against the Mayans, and there's been an attempt, a historical verification committee set up. So that's one way in which societies are trying to engage it. This issue of ownership and usage over land rights is fundamental. And it's fundamental, again, for the reason I alluded to earlier with corporates. You have in Philippines and Canada, just two examples of many, multinational corporations who are interested in engaging with indigenous peoples and the state to try and come to a mutually symbiotic relationship. Now, don't hold businesses to a moral standard. They're there to do business. They're not there to engage in morality. But while doing business, they can do moral business. But unfortunately, there isn't the kind of pressures put on them to engage that question or a view of what businesses do. So that becomes a fundamental issue, and I think that's where the big contestations are already taking place. High courts across the world, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore even, Australia, New Zealand, Fiji, the ones that I can think of, Ghana, Kenya, Uganda, India, all of these have high courts, and that's not to talk about Latin America, where this issue is even bigger. All of these high and supreme courts have cases at the moment about indigenous land rights vis-a-vis mining companies. Okay, so that's a fundamental issue as well. Okay, I have to finish up. Just one line on each of the others. Affirmative action package has become quite crucial. Again, I understand many of you are from the state, so you're familiar and probably have a view on affirmative action packages. Been tried in various places, some successes that I can talk to you about in the questions if you're interested. There is this notion that let's get the celebration of the cultural diversity. Let's paint ourselves as a multicultural state. For those of you who are watching the World Cup, you'll see that, of course, South Africa is trying that. Very much saying we are a multicultural, diverse society, and in that way trying to harm the rifts that have been caused. The importance of legal pluralism, you know, can you have different legal systems or should there just be one? Can you have Sharia courts in London? We have them. They exist. Whether you like them or not, they exist. Do Sharia courts hurt women's rights? The question that Andrea raised. Again, very important questions, and various systems are trying that and struggling with it. Ensuring public and political participation. And here you see, in a sense, my conclusion is ties in a little bit with what Andrea is saying. The importance of empowerment through public and political participation. Again, I can talk to you about some Finnish and Lebanese models. And lastly, power sharing, as it's called, consociationalism. I lived for a year in Northern Ireland, and it's very interesting to hear how Northern Irish pronounce consociationalism, but I won't try it with you. But essentially, that's again a model that's being tried in various places, and it's relevant in Iraq now. Trying to come to a power-sharing agreement in a constitution in Iraq that ultimately treats Sunni, Shia, and Kurds as equal stakeholders. And that's a real challenge. Unless we examine all of these issues, I suspect we will not come to any conclusions on multiculturalism, minorities, and human rights. But that's just my take, and there's some reading there that informs some of these things that I've been talking about. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. I'm actually going to change seats so my next presenter can manipulate his PowerPoint as he prefers. Our next and last speaker, and these are not in order of importance at all, is Dr. Michael Garapich. He is a social anthropologist working at the Center for Research on Nationalism, Ethnicity, and Multiculturalism, also known as CRONEM, at Roehampton University. He completed his PhD entitled Migration, Civil Society, and Power, Anthropological Perspectives on Polish Migrant Civic Participation in the UK at the Center for European Studies at the... Ooh, dear. Why don't you...
Jagiellonian University in Krakow.
That's one. My Polish pronunciation is very rusty, so apologies. With Janid, he is currently writing a monograph on Polish migrants' social class and ethnicity in London. His interests include long-distance nationalism, white immigrant groups' racism, contestation of nationalism in Poland, European Union integration, immigrant civic participation, and informal labor market strategies of marginalized groups. He has worked on numerous projects commissioned by local governments in London, which looked at various aspects of migration from Eastern Europe to London. His most recent research focuses on issues of homelessness and substance abuse among Eastern Europeans, and he has published in Polish, English, German, and French, which always embarrasses us Americans that usually don't speak that many languages. So thank you very much.
That's why I put it in the diary. My talk will be a little bit different in the sense that I will talk about a particular case study. So it will look in the micro scale on, nevertheless, very similar issues that my that speakers before have touched upon. Mainly, sort of using my own research among migrants from Poland, and my most recent research focuses on issues around destitution, homelessness, and poverty among immigrants. I'll present major difficulties with multicultural policy actually in this country, but overall the philosophy of multiculturalism, and that is its implicit essentialism and sort of treatment of the notion of culture, ethnicity, as something static, something objective, something that is can be taken out of human agency and objectively studied. Basically something unchangeable. And obviously anthropologists have these weaknesses towards all debates around multiculturalism, because after all, they were the ones who, in a way, made the notion of culture or notion of ethnicity renowned and help it enter the mainstream of public debates. So that's why I suppose there is still a need to remind to listen to what anthropologists still have to say about the cultural ethnicity, especially in the context of multiculturalism or minority rights or human rights. Basically, just in short take, multiculturalism can be described, and this is where the problems are, obviously, as both an idea and as a fact. So both a description, but also a proscription. So both, it suffers from a sort of classical natural fallacy problem where people, it's never sure whether we talk about something that is out there or something that we would like to be out there, or something, or we, whatever we describe the world that it is, or as it should be. And a lot of the problems relate to that, but obviously the growing recognition that the state needs to accept is, and this is where most of the successes of early multicultural policies back in the 60s or 70s come from, was the growing recognition actually that the whole myth that gave birth to 19th century nation states, the myth of a homogeneous monocultural, monolingual societies, nation states, is nothing but, it's just a myth, something that is a story that's been told back then, the 19th century, but it's no longer valid. And also, it's no longer a viable route for achieving a democratic and stable state. So there is a need of a new, total new narrative. And however, that multicultural philosophy obviously came under increasing scrutiny from critics and from academics over the last decade. And one of its outcomes was a now 10-year-old PAREC report on the future of multi-ethnic Britain, as it's called, where it makes it clear that we ought to rethink, actually, some of the major issues related to notions we use, so notions of culture, of community, of ethnicity, which has its implications for rights of local policies. And its main, I'm not going to get into that, but it's basically its main conclusion is, with obvious help of other contributors to that report, among them Stuart Hall, was that it's actually, it's wrong to think of communities or ethnicities as something that people have or something that is fixed, stable, and essentially identities in modern era are usually multifaced, diverse, and situational. And for instance, PAREC sort of stresses that obviously communities today are neither self-sufficient or fixed or, and stable, and they always and it's actually impossible to see in communities the sole bearers of legal right to difference. On the other hand, the whole notion of community is being the report looks at the issue of boundaries, which is increasingly recognized as the problem of boundary making as the core of the problems with the current multiculturalism. And in one of the quotes, PAREC says that obviously it's from one perspective to speak of black community or the Irish community or Bangladeshi community and so forth is to refer to some of the issues of, or related to strong sense of group solidarity, for example. Or it might mean also people who have particular fixed internal ties. But what he stresses is that it may also imply a homogeneous set, more or less, with fixed internal ties, but strongly defined boundaries. And for them, this is a very hopeless and misleading picture, to see the boundaries of communities as strongly defined and fixed. And this is where every anthropologist probably would question the very usage of the word boundaries here, because even if in that quote the thinking of boundaries as fixed and objective gives a misleading picture, it doesn't matter. I mean, as long as people believe in boundaries, as long as if they imagine them, they have a real effect. So it's not a question wherever these boundaries are observable, more or less, or legally defined, or wherever the state recognizes them. It's wherever the people actually see their communities as being bounded. Without them, without boundaries, communities don't exist in people's imagination, in people's sense of who they are. So, basically, without some idea of the boundary, we don't know how people define membership, who is in, who's out. So we have to have an idea of the process of exclusion and inclusion. Who actually defines who's in and who's out? Now, the main question is, obviously, in case of ethnic groups, are we talking about ethnic boundary or someone or something linked more with more obscure issues related to power relations or with social class-making practices where status, power, privilege, and prestige are at stake? In brief, is it how class boundaries are made in multicultural society, or is ethnicity, in that case, or community, actually a smokescreen for something going on internally in particular community or particular group? We have this probably infused by the sort of, I mean, anthropologists are obviously partly to blame, but overall we have the tendency to see sort of differences between groups as somewhat larger than differences within groups. And it's a tendency without really empirical grounds, because there's quite a lot of already body of knowledge in social anthropology.
Why I keeps doing this.
Basically,
Did you know you were here?
I was here. Basically, stressing the fact that we ought to think definitely we ought not to confuse ethnicity with culture, and we definitely need to treat ethnicity as a process that group membership is being negotiated and being fought for, which again might hide some more issue related to how stratification in within groups is being reproduced and made. Essentially, who has the voice? So who's in public discourse, for instance, who has the power to present themselves as representatives or as bearers of particular cultural traits? Who has the power to make himself or herself known to the majority? It is far from clear that it's all about the process of democratic ownership, where the majority and minority sort of agrees on certain rules of the game. What I argue is rather it all happens in rather obscure areas of political game, where people with certain access to corridors of powers are in better position to claim certain rights than others. And as an answer, I just will invite you to put some meat on the bone that I've just briefly sketched. I just invite you to have a look at this case study I'm just looking at now and sort of using my previous experience in researching Polish immigrants or Polish community, Polish groups, whatever you call them, in UK. Now, just a brief note, and I'm basically about homelessness. I mean, among immigrants I'm studying at the moment. It's a growing phenomenon. Enough to say that about 5 years ago, British government, the new Labour government, has announced proudly that they already solved the issue of homelessness. And in fact, in 2012, there'll be no homeless in at least in London or widely in England. And that it's over. We actually, New Labour was, with some credit to that, I mean, they were partially right. They had improved the situation comparing to late 80s and 90s. But nevertheless, they were very optimistic. The picture is now very, very different. And we've seen a huge growth of homelessness, rough sleeping, and people living in very, very destitute conditions like that, for example. It's a recent picture from London, North London. It's part of one of the Olympic sparrows, which is supposed to be sort of showered with cash, with the Olympic cash. And at the moment, I mean, I'm not going to sort of bore you with figures, but the overall rise is substantive, and around 30% of overall homeless population in London is composed of Polish immigrants. Now, I've been looking at the issue of associated dissolution for some from some time, but from this different perspective. And in my sort of previous projects and in current one, I've often interviewed or observe a reaction from the those that have power within the group. So the formal institutions, ethnic organizations that present themselves as representing the Polish community. And it's a various mix. It's very, very diverse. You have people living here for 50 years, Polish Brits who came after the war. You have some newcomers, organizations who, or people who came in the last few years. And the predominant attitude is that what homeless? I mean, there are no homeless. It's, everything is fine. I mean, it's these are people who if they accept there are some homeless or destitute migrants, there is a definitely a level of hostility towards even mentioning of the problem. So it's either denial, if it's a problem, then it's not our problem. And there are sort of various versions of that, but the level of hostility is pretty striking. These migrants that end up homeless are basically almost sort of de-ethnicized. So they are almost, in the eyes of sort of ethnic formal organizations, are not even Polish. They are just rough sleepers. They are just homeless. So, and in that, there are sort of various reasons to that. I mean, mainly because the politics of identity is woven around among Polish immigrants. It's woven around the story of success of the neoliberal route that makes you an economic migrant, meaning an innovative person who's striving for success, who's earning his way, and etc. etc. And but also someone who's self sufficient, and the story of homeless sort of goes strongly against that. Now, there is no, I don't have to mention that there is no actually even any attempts from ethnic organizations to offer any form of assistance or help. In the most radical case, the Polish Catholic Church, for example, is one place which instinctively some people might think that Polish migrants might go to. Now, overall, most of Polish migrants I met and I talked to, they have a different opinion. In their words, it's the last place they would go to, and the experience there is pretty grim. I mean, obviously, in the way that they're being turned away from closed doors. So, another telling example is the format of organization of new organizations being formed by Polish immigrants who are not homeless, who made it, who have a very distinct very specific class dimension in the name. These, there's not many of them, but these that are operating and are active are called like Polish professionals, and in the status of membership, only those that are professional or who are educated or who basically made it are allowed to participate. The other name of an organization is called Polish City Club, which organizes businessmen and basically people who are successful. And from the perspective of a sort of dominant discourse of multiculturalism, which stresses the ethnic ties as somewhat linking people, it is really clear why the level of hostility, why there's so strong distance between those that made it and those that hasn't. Just another picture of a dwelling here, of someone who's homeless. Now, throughout the interviews with leaders of organizations, the theme of losing reputation, losing face, of being associated with lower class, destitute migrants, is the one which offers the key why it is so. Basically, the formal organization have to, because they are being associated with homeless as on the basis of their ethnicity, they're forced to rise the class boundary. They're forced to present themselves as being more educated, more valuable, more productive to society. So the class boundary needs to be raised higher in order to fence off those that, on the basis of speaking the same language, have something to say. And for the homeless and destitute, the result is further exclusion, so and double marginalization. So not only for majority societies, from main society, but from their own ethnic groups. So to wrap up, the thing is that boundaries that make up modern communities, and if we look from close range how boundaries are made and remade, they're not made along ethnic lines. What we actually see behind the ethnic paravan, the ethnic screen, are strong stratification processes which are unfortunately hidden partly because of the multicultural discourses and public understanding of what multiculturalism is. And that class stratification often runs across what seemingly might be one ethnic community. What is presented publicly as an ethnic community is in fact an outcome of complex exclusionary practices on the basis of power and class. And if we keep reminding ourselves that ethnicity is a political resource to use by those who are in power, then we might actually recognize that this is a social class that is missing from the whole multicultural philosophy. And I'll finish here. Thank you.
I really want to thank all of our speakers, and our last presentation leaves us with a sort of a fitting picture to think of, and actually echoes Dr. Castellino's comments about how the bottom billion are not occupied in entire separate territories, but often within states or even within their own communities. And thinking to the first presentation, how do we attempt to empower individuals within their own communities to participate and either contest the norms, challenge them, or live within them? And so our panelists have raised some excellent questions. We have time for questions from the audience. I just want to say two things. I believe if people are interested in Dr. Castellino's handout, that they could contact me, and I would be happy to send a copy electronically as well. Okay, perfect. We can send those out. And also, Elsa, wave in the back. There's Elsa. Elsa's going to come around with the microphone to take your questions. Because we're recording, please wait until Elsa has the microphone in front of you before you begin your question in order that we can capture it. So please, questions for our speakers. Elsa?
Thank you all very much for your presentations. Dr. Castellino, toward the end of his talk, presented a number of, say, geopolitical solutions or attempts at solutions in dealing on a political level with multiculturalism. I wonder, acknowledging the complexity of these issues, whether you would hazard to ascribe a value judgment to one or two of those, and to the other panelists, from your perspective, whether you would.
Should I start?
Please.
Yeah, it is an interesting question. I mean, the societies are addressing this question. And I think you, earlier in the plenary panel, somebody asked Dr. Inanna a question, and she said, in what context? And I think the context is probably the place to start with, that in a kind of post-colonial setting, the question would be quite differently framed to the kind of question that I think Michael's work is looking at, which is an established state within groups. So it would be the whole multicultural debate would be quite different depending on what perspective you look at it from. From the post-colonial perspective, very briefly, the average post-colonial state is 35 to 40 years old. That's not enough. When you compare it to Germany, France, England, these are states that have developed, well, at least since the Peace of Westphalia, 1648. So that's the kind of time frame. Now, also inevitably, in the post-colonial states context, states have had to pick one identity to say, we will unite behind the Indonesian flag, which means we will speak Bahasa Indonesia and be Muslim. That has impact on those who don't speak Bahasa Indonesia and are not Muslim. So the question of multiculturalism in a post-colonial context is fundamentally different from the multiculturalism we talk about in the developed setting, if you like. I don't think, and I'm a lawyer, so I perhaps I've missed the debate, I don't think there's quite enough of the discussion on multiculturalism in the post-colonial context. From my perspective as a lawyer, I find that we are more practical anyway. We don't always get these discussions. We ought to, but we don't always get these discussions. So we look at law as being the road through which you will create the space of interaction. Now, law is a limited tool, right? Law can't make you love your neighbor, but law can build a fence to make sure that when you're behind those fences, you will interact in a manner. And so I think law has been a very limited tool, and we see this now in the context that Jennifer raised at the start, where she said, you know, the issue of the burqa now in Europe. The European Court of Human Rights is being asked this question pointedly in various different shapes and forms. Is it okay to wear your national religious dress when you are performing a public function? And, you know, you can look at about 300 or 400 pages of judgment, but basically the answer is, we don't really know. That's the answer, right? And the other question is, even though we've created this human rights space, there are whole issues where we just can't tackle it. So religion. Beyond saying you have a right to religion, we can't say very much more. So you have a right to religion, great. Does that mean you can perform religious practices that discriminate against women? No, but you have a right to religion. So we have these difficulties, and I think, and so I don't think I'm the right person to answer the question in terms of in my area. Societies are trying it. New Zealand now, for instance, I don't think has succeeded in creating a multicultural environment, but certainly a bicultural one, where Maori rights and Pakeha rights, settler rights, are respected equally. Kazakhstan is trying to come to this multicultural attitude, because if you think of Kazakhstan, it's about 60% Kazakh, and the remaining are other ethnic groups from the surrounding areas with a big ethnic Russian population. India still is in that mode of one Indian unity, which now, in the context of the so-called war against terror, sees Muslims as a problem. Also, the Indian identity is really problematic around the Dalit question, around the question of untouchability. So the various states that I've been looking at, there are elements that you could say are better than others, but I don't think I can conclusively give you a great model that I would follow.
Okay. Well, in reply to the question, I want to preface that, first of all, with a comment that I'm not entirely as confident as Joshua is that we indeed know what human rights are. One of the worries I have, for example, that when it comes, you mentioned conventions on the rights of women. The Convention on the Rights of Women, CEDAW, has had more opt-outs than opt-ins almost. There are lots of qualifications here. So we are not yet, to my mind, we cannot yet confidently assume that we know what human rights are and simply need to roll this out and find mechanisms for doing that. So with that particular qualifier, I think what is interesting about the list that Joshua produced here is that these constitute a variety of mechanisms, and most of them alert us to the need for bottom-up. I think where things go wrong is when we try to devise an abstract framework and simply roll it out in diverse sets and contexts. Certainly working in the area I've worked in to do with gender and culture, it did alert me as a white Western liberal feminist to some of my own prejudices and my own misconceptions about what constitutes equality. And I think that that is a lesson that is worth learning in general about how we deal with questions of diversity. That you need mechanisms that allow for grassroots participation and for people to actually explain what it is that they are seeking, because we very often will misunderstand. But I think when it comes to models of multiculturalism, also a word of warning. There's a considerable backlash at the moment to this very concept. Politically, certainly within Britain, there has been greater unease. And again, it shows the need for, we still are at a point where we need to make a case for it, not presume that we've made it and now we're looking for the various kind of mechanisms that we can implement comfortably in various kinds of settings. So I can see worth in all five of these mechanisms. I don't think any one of them should take a uniquely privileged position, because if, like me, you believe in bottom-up and contextualism, then the mechanisms that will work will depend on the kind of conditions in which you operate and the kind of demands that are being made. But, as I said, two words of caution. Don't assume that you've made your case for human rights, and don't assume that you've already succeeded in the argument for greater diversity.
I'm not sure if I'm the good person really to ask that, to answer that, but I will just retake on what I stated at the beginning, that a lot of the problems around multiculturalism stems from mixing the description and the ought and what we wish things would look like. And depending where we look, these things look differently. Now, just sort of restating my background, I think what it is, from descriptive point of view and sort of more anthropological side, this is, I mean, the fact is that there's no such thing as a non-multicultural society. There never was. I mean, human evolution is actually laden with cultural interaction, and there was no ever isolated cultures that sort of, you know, were isolated islands and which developed by their own means. Culture develops through interaction. And there is no, and from a sort of naive perspective, looking at dynamics of interaction of multiculturalism, but how it looks like in a mundane, sort of banal way, I would say Britain is not doing that bad, because if you look at London with its 360 language groups and etc., and look at the number of sort of potential conflict or problems or sort of deep-seated problems in terms of discrimination, it could be worse. It's not that the potential of conflict is huge, but the outcome is I would say it's positive. How does it happen is a different thing. It happens not through design, definitely. It doesn't happen that someone sat and thought that, okay, we're going to organize it this way. It happens more organically, happens more in a banal, mundane way, just because people, contrary to some, have a tendency to get on with culturally different people, because this is the way they define themselves. Now, I know it might sound a naive perspective from, and sort of very, from a perspective of a, you know, relatively small, rich country, and developed, it looked elsewhere very, very different, but I suppose that's my take, that if we divide what the descriptive part of multiculturalism and accept that this is in human nature to live in a diverse environment from the ought, then we might be maybe at least make a first step to think what's good in a particular context.
We're very close to time, and I don't want to keep anyone from lunch. Can I get a sense of how many people are burning to ask a question? I see that there's one. You had one in the back in the brown. Let's take two questions in succession, and if I could ask our respondents to keep the answers fairly brief, and we can get these in. I know you had your hand up in the brown, and then I see one in the back. And I'm sure our panelists are all joining us for lunch, so they might be amenable to being approached over the meal as well. So we'll take these two in succession.
Hi. I'd just be interested in your individual views on the potential ban of the burqa in France. I was just curious as to your individual views on the potential ban of the burqa in France and why you stand in the debate.
Mm-hmm. And we'll take that one as well.
My question is, to what extent do you think we should take seriously the performativity of these categories that we create? What I mean is, when academics or policymakers talk about minorities or majorities, people start to think of themselves as a minority. They think as a minority, they behave as a minority. When people are told that they are the majority, they start thinking as a majority. So how can we avoid this situation where we reproduce the same problems we're trying to describe or tackle? And if people can say something quickly about ways that people find a way from or to circumvent the problem of the hierarchy of values. So we talked about freedom for religion, and gender equality, and whatever they're defined. And there are hierarchies that people try to portray that this one is more important than the others. Like, well, what ways have people developed to avoid this hierarchy?
The burqa in France, I think, first of all, we need to distinguish between the long-standing French debate about the headscarf in schools and more current debates about the wearing of the burqa in public places. Mustn't get those two debates confused, because I think they raise different kinds of concerns. For those who aren't familiar, headscarf debate, girls wanting to wear the traditional headscarf in French schools, this gets ruled out on the basis of violating French conceptions of laïcité. I think that kind of debate is highly contentious, and the French conception of laïcité as a particular expression of liberal secularism does not allow a great deal of room to maneuver for minorities. And while the questions raise issues over whether or not these young women were free to choose the headscarves, whether it was their own interest that they were expressing or whether they were pressurized into it, these are, of course, legitimate concerns. But to have a principled ruling in the fashion in which France has done, I think, is contentious. The burqa, the not wearing the burqa in French public places, I don't feel I can, again, it's a question of how these issues are framed. The way the public debate is being conducted takes it as a given that no woman would ever choose to dress in that fashion voluntarily. That in itself needs to be debated. Yes, I would not want to see women forced down an avenue, down into a dress code that I personally would not wish to wear, that I personally would find deeply restrictive. Yet I also have to take on board debates that come, for example, from Egyptian feminists, where this perception of the burqa as automatically a symbol of women's subordination is being challenged, where they say, well, this can also be a way of removing yourself from sexual pressures, a way of creating a different kind of space for yourself. What I would like to see in France is a much more open debate about these things, where the issues are not prejudged, and where the language that is being used is not that hostile. The language that is being used by some French politicians is extremely confrontational towards minorities, and I don't think that that is helpful. So on the burqa, I feel a little bit less sure, but would welcome constructive public debate that doesn't automatically predefine issues.
I think in the interest of time, if I could ask Dr. Castellino and Dr. Garapich to address themselves to the second question,
that would be great.
I was going
to do that anyway, because I agree with that analysis. And to say that, you know, you can't resolve this analysis by saying, let's decide what French values were 200 years ago. Because France has changed, and France has been an actor of change. And France has changed as a result of it. But that also ties into your question in a sense of this definition. I think of it as the Slobodan Milosevic question. So here you have Yugoslavia living in harmony. Sure, there's differences there. But suddenly you start asserting, oh, but I'm not Yugoslav. I'm Serb, which means you're Croatian, which means you're Bosnian. Oh, but what is Bosnian? Well, you're Muslim anyway. So you have this thing, and you're right, absolutely. And the way international politics is set up, it's given to identity entrepreneurs. You can be an identity entrepreneur, and you can get something for it. You can get a nice big house. You can become a diplomat because you're representing your community. It is a danger, without a doubt, and it's a fine line. And states are behaving quite differently with it. The French attitude, actually, to tie into the other question in a sense, the French attitude is we have no minorities. Everybody within France is French. Well, try telling that to the Arabs in the suburbs outside Paris, who know that if they are Zinedine Zidane, they can win the World Cup for France, irrespective of the shambolic performance this time around. But they can't be a brain surgeon, you know? So there is this question of the extent to which you can be tagged and the tags fit. Turkey has a similar issue. Turkey says the only minorities we recognize are those in the Lausanne Treaty. So you have different states behaving quite differently towards it. The Chinese attitude actually towards this is it's called a Stalinist definition. Essentially, China said, if you read the Chinese constitution, it's all about how the Communist Party swept into power in 1949, defeated Chiang Kai-shek, and brought unity to China, reuniting China's nations. And the Chinese constitution is all about how we need to create a system to combat Han chauvinism. 7% of Chinese population are national minorities. So what China did in the 50s was it had a commission to say, let's work out who the minorities are and assess them. So China is described as a nation of 56 nationalities, one of which, the Han, are the majority, and the remaining 55 are minorities. So in the Chinese case, your question doesn't arise. If you fit in the 55, you're a minority. If you don't, forget about it. So there are different states have had different attitudes, but I absolutely agree with your point. It is a risk. But you still need to get beyond the risk and work out. And for me, the answer is to look at GDP per head. Can you see a trend that identifies a group of people by some commonality, identity, religion, whatever the factors might be? And if they are experiencing discrimination collectively, it means they are being denied access to the human rights table. Then I think you need to act. So for me, it is fairly straightforward.
And there's not much I can add, really, except that the academics themselves would need to realize and understand what the impact of the concept theories, but also sort of notions they use and publicly disseminate is. I mean, they need to be constantly aware what is the impact. And this is where the challenge lies, because in the media savvy world, in the media crazy world, often academics began to compete for attention in a similar way as celebrities do, and because it carries with itself recognition, grants, publication, etc. Now, so this is a question about really academics' ethics and ethics of research, because at the same time, there are some people who have trusted you in telling you stories. That's sort of from methodological point. And on that question, I would say, I mean, publicly, no problem with that. But I would have a problem with, as a lecturer, as an examiner, with such a person. And this is you ask for a personal opinion, not sort of I don't have a theory about this. But my personal opinion, yes. And while I'm teaching students, I would like to see their faces. I like to see if they nod or understand me. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank our panelists, and especially for being forbearing with me as I kept us to strict time. It's never a pleasant task. So just to wrap up as a token of appreciation, we have some very lovely chocolate champagne to present to you. So a round of applause for our panelists. Thank you.